Hello, ahlan wa sahlan, and welcome to another episode of Arab Voices, a syndicated radio talk show that airs on dozens of radio stations in the US and Europe since 2002. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. During this episode of Arab Voices, episode number 1193, I will air the latest episode from the Electronic Intifada Radio, in which Noura Burrows-Feedman and Ali Abu Ni'ma discuss UN Security Council Resolution 2803, where Craig Mukhaiber, former senior UN human rights official and international human rights lawyer. We will hear from Ali Abu Ni'ma reporting on Palestinians from Gaza recently released from Israeli detention who have given heroic descriptions of sexual torture by their Israeli captors. We will hear Dunya Abu Sitta reporting on the return of medical patients who had been receiving treatment outside of Gaza. And we'll hear John Elmer covering the latest exchange of fallen captives and the Israeli military's use of the Yellow Line as pretext to continue destroying eastern Gaza. Let's listen in.
Welcome to Electronic Intifada Radio. I'm Noura Burrows-Feedman. On this episode, Gaza Betrayed. We speak with international human rights lawyer Craig Mukhaiber about the United Nations' adoption of Trump's Gaza plan.
It's not about protecting the victims of the genocide, it's about protecting the perpetrators of the genocide. It's not about holding the perpetrators accountable, it's about disempowering and punishing the survivors. The governments of the world have again betrayed the Palestinian people.
On the resistance report, John Elmer covers ongoing Israeli ceasefire violations.
The idea was to agree to phase one and then move on to negotiations for phase two, not to just barrel ahead with a colonial arrangement. So upholding the agreement by the resistance is obviously only a one-sided affair.
Ali Abu Ni'ma reports that extreme torture and sexual violence against Palestinian prisoners is a systematic policy as part of Israel's genocide.
Thousands of Palestinians are still held in these military detention camps and prisons with no access from human rights organizations or from the International Red Cross. So all the abuses are still continuing.
This is Electronic Intifada Radio. I'm Noura Burrows-Feedman. This episode highlights the news, interviews, and reports from our live stream broadcast on November 20th, 2025. Later in the show, we'll be joined by international human rights lawyer Craig Mukhaiber to discuss the resolution adopted by the United Nations Security Council and what may come next. Ali Abu Ni'ma reports on Palestinians from Gaza, recently released from Israeli detention, who have given harrowing descriptions of sexual torture by their Israeli captors. And on the resistance report, John Elmer covers the Israeli military's use of the Yellow Line as pretext to continue destroying eastern Gaza. But first, we're hearing families in Khan Yunis awaiting dozens of medical patients who are receiving treatment in hospitals in occupied East Jerusalem, returning to Gaza on buses through the Kerem Abu Salem or Kerem Shalom crossing. Amid the joy and relief of their families, these patients come back to a landscape of utter destruction and a collapsed healthcare system with limited access to basic medication and treatments. The Electronic Intifada's contributor, Dunya Abu Sitta, sent us this report.
Imagine leaving your home for just a few days to seek medical treatment, only to be separated from your family for 2 years. While you are away, they live under bombing and fire, moving from one tent to another, facing hunger, fear, and genocide. This is not fiction. It's the reality of dozens, perhaps hundreds of families from Gaza who left for treatment in hospitals in the West Bank before the war began. Then the border closed and they become watching the news with a broken heart. On last Monday, I was studying by the light of my laptop screen, as we do in Gaza, since electricity has been cut off for 2 years, When I heard loud cheering from Nasser Hospital, I stepped out into the window and saw a crowd joyfully chanting. I thought it were welcoming home realized prisoners, but the surprise came the next day. They weren't prisoners. They were patients who had finally returned to Gaza after 2 years of celebration, pain, and waiting. Imagine returning to your city, which you left carrying only the pain of your illnesses, and finding it only rubble. Imagine looking for your home and finding nothing. Look for your sibling, but not seeing them. Searching for your mother and finding her buried under the rubble. These stories are not exception. They are chapters in ongoing tragedy. Their story deserves to be written, read, and heard.
That was the Electronic Intifada's contributor, Donya Abu Sitta, in Khan Yunus. Next, our executive director, Ali Abu Nima, reports that horrific sexual torture of Palestinian prisoners is systematic policy as part of Israel's genocide, rather than isolated incidents.
Now, I do have to warn you that this segment will include frank discussion about sexual violence and torture. That's something I wrote about in my recent article, Palestinians Recount Gang Rapes by Israeli Soldiers and Dogs. Palestinians from Gaza recently released from Israeli detention have given harrowing descriptions of sexual torture by their Israeli captors, describing rapes by groups of soldiers, forced stripping, forced filming, and sexual assaults and rapes using objects and dogs. The Palestinian Center for Human Rights, which collected the testimonies in recent weeks, said they reflect a systematic policy as part of Israel's genocide and are not isolated incidents. PCHR published four testimonies from Palestinian rape victims identified only by initials. The accounts are very explicit, and I'm only going to give summaries that do not include the worst, most horrific details that can be found in the PCHR report or in my article. N.A., a 42-year-old mother, says she was stripped, restrained, and over a period of days was repeatedly sexually assaulted by multiple Israeli soldiers. She also describes being beaten, electrocuted, insulted, and filmed. She heard cameras clicking and was told her photos could be posted online. A.A., a 35-year-old man, reported that a trained dog was used in the sexual assault against him and that the experience caused him serious psychological and physical harm, including a head injury that was stitched up without anesthesia. T.O., a 41-year-old father, describes a soldier violently sexually assaulting him with an object and then doing other unspeakable acts. He says he bled as a result of the attack, was blindfolded, tied up, and moved to another location where he was repeatedly beaten along with other prisoners. M.A., an 18-year-old Palestinian male, says he was repeatedly sexually assaulted with an object and also witnessed similar attacks on other detainees held with him. He also mentions a dog being present during some of that abuse. As we've reported, very little of this has drawn much mainstream attention in the West, where politicians and media have focused on Israel's fake claims of rape on October 7th, something that we've covered extensively on the Electronic Intifada. But one of the very few cases of a Palestinian victim drawing mainstream attention involved a detainee gang-raped and severely injured by a group of Israeli soldiers at Israel's Sde Teman detention camp. It came to light last year after several soldiers were arrested for the attack by Israeli military prosecutors, and a leaked video of the assault was broadcast on Israeli national television. After the video's release in August 2024, the UN Human Rights Office stated that it has, quote, documented a number of videos in recent months which show gross violations of the rights of Palestinians detained by Israel, including acts of ill treatment, torture, sexual violence, and rape. The Sde Teman video led to outrage in Israel, not about the attack itself, but in defense of the soldiers. It sparked so-called right-to-rape protests by Israelis demanding the soldiers' release, while senior officials justified their actions.
Yifat Tomer Yerushalmi, the Israeli military prosecutor who leaked the video in a failed effort to tamp down the outrage over the soldiers' arrests, resigned last month and has been arrested and placed in home detention. She's being investigated over the leak. Now, what I want to bring to your attention now that has come to light since we reported on this story is comments from Ben Marmarelli speaking to Canadian journalist Samira Mohyeddin. Marmarelli represents a Palestinian prisoner held by Israel, and he says that his client, a Palestinian political prisoner, is being subjected to severe abuse, including repeated sexual violence. Here's a clip of Marmarelli commenting not on his own client in this clip, but on that infamous case of the rape of the Palestinian detainee seen in that video leaked in August 2024. Let's listen to him.
A more broader question about the treatment of Palestinian prisoners. Were you surprised at all with the leak of that video showing how prisoners are being treated in Sidi Timan?
Listen, what they did is they found a scapegoat because they raped all of the prisoners, in Sidi Timan especially. And not only that they raped all of the prisoners, they have cameras filming 24/7. So if they really wanted to act against the rape and the beatings and the torture, we could have done this years ago. They don't do it. And what they did is, because there was such international fallout, they decided to pick just one case and go after it. Mm. By the way, they dropped the ball on that as well, because that case is over. Nobody's taken to court on this case. The only case that was leaked, they released one of the detainees. That's really the, instead of Iman, it's detainees. It's under the IDF. It's not under the IPS. Now, instead of Iman, they released the victim of this case without taking his testimony. So if you understand a little bit about criminal law, that means the case is over.
Right.
So that's Israeli lawyer Ben Marmarelli talking to Samira Mohyeddin and alleging that they rape all of the prisoners. And I want to share some of the other comments Marmarelli made in that interview about his own client, another Palestinian political prisoner. And Ben Marmarelli says, quote, "It's gotten to the point where he asks me not to come anymore because every time I come, they rape him." Marmarelli added that sexual assaults are only part of a bigger pattern of torture and abuse. He says, quote, "Everyone talks about the rape like it's the big issue. The rape is not the big issue. The rape is the least of his problems," Marmarelli said. "The issue is the conditions of the prisoners, and the rape is just one of the many pieces of the puzzle, which is Israel torturing the Palestinian prisoners." Marmarelli also said his client had showed him boot marks on his back, deep marks on his wrists from tight handcuffs, and bruises all over his body. He also alleges that sexual assaults occur once every few weeks and appear to coincide with the lawyer's visits. Marmarelli says Palestinian political prisoners don't get any visits for years. Their only connection to the outside world is a lawyer's visit. And even that, according to him, is now too dangerous because of the retaliation that Israel metes out. And I want to point to another story that came out from the Associated Press. The headline, "Palestinian deaths in Israeli custody have surged. A prison guard describes rampant abuse." And the Associated Press actually published an account given by a former Israeli prison guard. And here's what the Associated Press says. "The former guard at a military prison notorious for its harsh treatment of Palestinians told the AP, detainees were routinely shackled with chains and kicked and hit with batons, and that the facility has been dubbed a graveyard because so many prisoners were dying there. He agreed to talk to AP to raise awareness of violence in Israeli prisons and spoke on condition of anonymity due to fear of reprisal." And you'll recall that, as we've reported in recent weeks, since the so-called ceasefire came into effect in Gaza on October 10th, Israel has returned dozens of bodies of Palestinian detainees that were mutilated, decomposed, and disfigured, but showed signs of torture, gagging, blindfolding, even had things tied around their necks, suggestive of really horrific abuse and mistreatment. And many of these bodies have been buried in Gaza without being identified because their condition was so bad. Meanwhile, what's happening in Israel? Well, rapists, torturers continue to be celebrated. And one example of that is the suspect in that notorious Sidi Timan rape case that was shown in the video leaked in August 2024 being celebrated and received as heroes at a recent court hearing. Let's take a look at that. What a sick, sick society. Those scenes of celebration are matched by many comments from senior Israeli politicians praising these suspects, dehumanizing Palestinian prisoners. And as the Palestinian Center for Human Rights points out, thousands of Palestinians are still held in these military detention camps and prisons with no access from human rights organizations or from the International Red Cross. So all the abuses that we've just talked about are still continuing. All of this is under the banner of what Donald Trump calls a ceasefire and peace. So keep the Palestinian prisoners in your thoughts. Keep demanding their freedom. They are far from freedom and they're still suffering horrendous abuse in Israeli detention.
That was our executive director, Ali Abu Nima. Still to come on Electronic Intifada Radio, international human rights lawyer Craig Mokhiber unpacks Resolution 2803 as the UN embraces colonialism. But before we get to that, the Electronic Intifada's John Elmer reports on the ongoing Israeli ceasefire violations as the Qassam shadow units maintain their promise to return fallen Israeli captives.
This is the resistance report for day 776 of Israel's genocide in Gaza. It's also day 42 of the ceasefire that Israel has violated now more than 400 times, killing and wounding 1,000 Palestinians in the past 41 days. So we're seeing shadow unit soldiers from the Qassam Brigade. The shadow unit looks after prisoners. So these recovery operations are taking place in Rafah, Khan Yunis, Zeytun, and Shujaiya in Gaza City. This much needed heavy machinery is being used to find Israelis right now and is not being used for recovery of Palestinians. There's more than 10,000 we know are buried in rubble because of Israel's genocide. So there have been 26 out of 28 of the fallen captives have been returned. All 20 soldiers were returned, and almost all of the fallen captives are also soldiers, or as the Israelis said the other day, according to information and intelligence available to the IDF, Command Sergeant Major Lior Rudolph was a deputy security coordinator and a member of the Nur Yitzhak Rapid Response Team, and he fell in battle defending his kibbutz on October 7th. So we're getting soldiers and security officials. The exchange is 15 to 1 for the bodies, and those Palestinian bodies are returned, and only a fraction of them could be identified because of the torture and mutilation and executions that they suffered. That is the Qassam Brigade's obligation under the first phase of this agreement. They signed on to this ceasefire agreement in order to end the genocide on their people, to end the aggression. The idea was to agree to phase one and then move on to negotiations for phase two, not to just barrel ahead with a colonial arrangement. So upholding the agreement by the resistance is obviously only a one-sided affair. Asim Al-Nabi, who we know as a guest on this program, a regular contributor to the Electronic Intifada, and an engineer at the Gaza municipality who is now reporting for Al Arabi television. He did a report using municipality know-how to go neighborhood by neighborhood along the yellow line. And he found in his inaugural report for Al Arabi that 62% of Gaza is actually under control, an additional 9% from what was supposed to be the yellow line that was agreed to has been upheld. The Israelis are pushing that even further. There was a statement recently by Hamas on the ceasefire that says the occupation continues on a daily basis to demolish homes located inside areas of controls outside the yellow line on the eastern side in a clear, explicit breach of the ceasefire agreement. These violations have continued for a full month without stopping, leading to widespread destruction of citizens' property inside that area. Hamas also added that the occupation has not adhered to the agreed-upon withdrawal line for its first phase. It has exceeded the yellow line by an estimated 33 square kilometers, which includes fire control within distances ranging from 400 to 1,000 meters inside the line and the incursion of military vehicles into these areas. The occupation has also placed concrete blocks that exceed the yellow line by distances ranging from 2 to 800 meters along the temporary line. The United States Central Command Civil Military Coordination Center in Kiryat Gat, which is housing right now 200 United States soldiers, as well as officials from other countries. And the map that they're using for their operational purposes looks to be an expanded yellow line from the previous maps. And in this coordination center, there was a Washington Post story explaining how the coordination would work and how the American headquarters would function. And after that story came out, the Israeli security sources immediately went to Army Radio to say this. This is a report from Army Radio. The political echelon in Israel will continue to make exclusive decisions about the types of materials allowed and forbidden to enter the Strip, and the entire coordination system of international organizations at the UN for humanitarian aid trucks will continue to operate through the coordination of government activities in the territories, COGAT. So the Israeli Defense Forces will be in full control of the aid. The Washington Post story and many of the ways that Trump talks about his plan is that the Americans are in charge of monitoring this. The Israelis made it very clear that that is not true. Israel further clarified that all security inspection processes of aid trucks and their contents will remain at the crossings under the control of Israeli security bodies, alongside taking necessary actions by security systems to reduce Hamas involvement in humanitarian aid. Also, the BBC has published satellite imagery. What it says are more than 1,500 buildings that have been destroyed on the eastern side of the yellow line. This is all destruction that has happened after the ceasefire was agreed to. So they're adding to what the UN estimates is 60 million tons of rubble. They've been adding to that since the ceasefire. And more than 300,000 homes were destroyed before the ceasefire ended. And now we see 1,500 more buildings destroyed since the ceasefire. There is enough rubble in Gaza to fill 13 Great Pyramids. The BBC says the new photos, the latest of which was taken on November 8th, showed the entire neighborhoods controlled by the Israeli Defense Forces have been leveled in less than a month. The actual number of destroyed buildings could be significantly higher, with satellite imagery for some areas being unavailable for BBC's assessment. That is something that Israel has done throughout this war and before, making satellite imagery difficult, and it's always low resolution. Back to the BBC, they say U.S. President Donald Trump's 20-point peace plan and the basis for the ceasefire stated that all military operations will be suspended. It's cut and dried, it's black and white, and he has since repeated that the war is over. And that is clearly not the case. BBC says, we used a change detection algorithm to analyze radar images taken before and after the ceasefire to highlight these changes, which might indicate destruction, then manually counted visibly destroyed buildings. So labor-intensive process by BBC Verify. It's good to have them doing this now, although it would have been nice to have this all throughout the war from BBC Verify. In any case, There are still negotiations ongoing for some 200, it's thought to be some 200 Qassam fighters or Palestinian resistance fighters in general in Rafah. Hamas said the other day that we have informed the mediators of our readiness to remove the fighters from behind the yellow line. And Qassam issued a full statement that says the occupation bears full responsibility for the clashes with our fighters in Rafah who are defending themselves inside an area under its control. The enemy must know that the principle of surrender and handing over oneself to the enemy does not exist in the lexicon of the Al-Qassam brigades. We place the mediators before their responsibilities and they must find a solution to ensure the continuation of the ceasefire, prevent the enemy from using flimsy pretexts to violate it and exploit that to target innocent and civilians in Gaza. The process of recovering bodies during the first phase took place under complex and extremely difficult circumstances. Despite this, we adhered to what was required of us in the agreement, which they have. The IDF Chief of Staff, Eyal Zamir, said that the military must be ready to seize additional territory in the Gaza Strip beyond the current ceasefire lines if necessary. In the Gaza Strip, we control more than 50% of the territory without controlling the population. The yellow line serves as an encirclement and control policy that we will continue to act to prevent Hamas's buildup and by our holding strategic terrain and all the gateways into Gaza. Zamir said during his visit to Rafah in southern Gaza, he added, if required, we must be prepared for rapid transition to a broad offensive and to seize territory in the Gaza Strip on the other side of the yellow line. We will continue to clear the area of Hamas infrastructure and enemy pockets. We will continue to insist that Hamas's rule will not exist on the other side of the border. Even if this takes time, we will pursue it and persist in the mission of dismantling Hamas and demilitarizing the Strip. So Israel, clearly fully involved in this process, appears to be ready to go to war at any time, which is why they're taking the kind of actions with widespread airstrikes all across Gaza, killing and wounding hundreds of Palestinians. They don't believe that this civil military coordination center that the United States Central Command is overseeing is going to stop that. And that has been the case so far. We got a message from the Qassam Brigades this week, a video message that shows the resilience of the population in Gaza. It shows the doctors, the journalists, many of whom were assassinated. And the text here is Izzedine Al-Haddad, who is now the Qassam Brigade's chief. Previously, he was the Gaza Division chief. And he says, over these many months of pain and bloodshed, our people have refused to surrender and stood anchored on their land. Our great people, who are unparalleled in all of the world, were the backbone of this struggle as they stood tall on their land, recording on the pages of history that they are a people who refuse to bow to injustice, offering everything for their homeland. We in the resistance salute your bravery, dignity, and honor. And that was Izzedine Al-Haddad. So that is the resistance report for this week.
That was the Electronic Intifada's John Elmer. You're listening to Electronic Intifada Radio with me, Nora Barrows-Friedman. On November 17th, the United Nations Security Council adopted the so-called Trump Peace Plan for Gaza. Resolution 2803 effectively makes the United States and Israel the joint rulers of Gaza, aided by complicit governments from the region and around the world. Craig Mochaber, former senior UN human rights official and international human rights lawyer, joins me and Ali Abunima. His latest article for Mondo Weiss is called The UN Embraces Colonialism, Unpacking the Security Council's Mandate for the U.S. Colonial Administration of Gaza. Craig, welcome back to Electronic Intifada Radio.
Hi, Ali. Hi, Nora.
Craig, you begin your article with this observation. More than 2 years into the genocide in Palestine, the UN Security Council has finally acted, but rather than acting to enforce international law, protect the victims, and hold the perpetrators accountable, it adopted a resolution that openly flouts key provisions of international law, disempowers and further punishes the victims, and rewards and empowers the perpetrators. Give us an overview of why you and others are reacting so strongly to the resolution in these terms.
Well, I mean, obviously, this resolution is a real direct assault on the Palestinian people, on their human rights, on their hopes of liberation. It is an atrocity with a UN insignia on it. I've never seen anything like that in all the years that I've been following the UN. Of course, I wasn't alive when the UN General Assembly purported to recommend partition of Palestine against the wishes of the Palestinian people, which was a completely unlawful move on their part, although that ultimately wasn't adopted and was ignored subsequently by all actors. But this is the closest historical parallel that I can imagine. What the UN Security Council has done here is not only an assault on the Palestinian people and their rights, but it is a threat to the entire world in a very real way. The Security Council has awesome power. It is empowered to even use force and to impose action against countries, against the will of the people living in those countries under Chapter 7. And so I've said, when the Security Council acts outside the bounds of international law and beyond the powers that it has received from the UN Charter, it is an instrument of repression and a very dangerous one. And what the Security Council has done here is they have completely pushed aside all the requirements of international law and their own limitations in the UN Charter on advancing only action that is consistent with the purposes and principles of the UN. And they have dismissed all of the recent findings of the International Court of Justice on what international law says and proceeded with what was clearly unlawful and ultra vires, beyond the power of the council to do this, but with real threats to the rights of the Palestinian people. You know, just recently, the International Court of Justice has ruled that the Palestinians have the right to self-determination and that Israel has to be held accountable. Despite those findings of the court, the resolution strips away the right to self-determination. And not only does it do that, it empowers hostile foreign forces, including the US, a co-perpetrator of the genocide, to govern the Palestinian people. The court found that all of the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and Gaza are illegally occupied, and that occupation must end quickly and completely. That's the requirement of international law. This resolution explicitly extends the Israeli occupation of Gaza. It endorses the indefinite presence of Israeli regime troops, at least in the perimeter inside of Gaza. And then I've said it superimposes a second US-led occupation on top of the Israeli occupation, not just in violation of what international law and the International Court of Justice has said, but driving it significantly in reverse in that case. The court has historically last year said that after 30 years plus of Oslo, in which the Palestinians were told they didn't have any rights and they had to negotiate for their rights with their oppressor, the court said, no, that's not true. Those rights are inalienable and they're not subject to any political process or conditions or agreement. This resolution nullifies all of those rights, and then it assigns Palestinian rights to the discretion of the United States in consultation with the Israelis and other partners as well. And in the midst of the genocide and the findings of the courts, there's not a single mention of the crime of genocide. No mention of the apartheid that the court has found or of the colonization, no mention of the thousands of Palestinians that are still held in Israeli torture and death camps. And here's another requirement of international law. International law requires accountability for perpetrators and redress for victims. And none of that is covered here. And then, you know, just one more outrageous element here. The court has also found that Israel is responsible for compensation and reparations for all of the harms and damages that it has caused. This resolution, adopted by the Security Council, takes that responsibility away from the Israeli regime as the perpetrator, and it gives it to international donors, the World Bank, international financial institutions, and what I've said is a multi-billion dollar bailout of the Israeli regime as it perpetrates a genocide. It's outrageous for Palestinians, but it's also a threat to the rest of the world, and it has to be opposed every step of the way by anyone who believes in the rule of law. Sadly, 15 member states of the United Nations, all members of the Security Council, have bowed down to the U.S. empire, rejected every principle of international law and their own responsibilities in the Security Council to allow this atrocity to pass.
What happens now after this resolution is passed? What does it mean? What are we going to see on the ground in the coming days, weeks, months in Gaza?
Well, it's not a very realistic plan, to be sure. I think they're going to have a hell of a time getting a lot of countries to sign on to provide their troops to be proxy occupation forces on behalf of the Israeli regime and the Americans and ostensibly to do battle with the Palestinian resistance. By the way, you know, international law says that the Palestinian people have a right to armed resistance against foreign occupation, colonial domination, and racist regimes. That has been the source of their legitimacy in struggling against the Israeli regime because it meets all three of those criteria. What's been set up here is an extension of the unlawful occupation of Palestine in breach of all of that. So, you know, these troops, these countries all are put on notice from the Palestinian resistance that, you know, don't join into the occupation and oppression of the Palestinian people. And so I think they're going to have a challenge there. There are so many pieces of this, so many points at which it could come completely unraveled, but it can do a lot of damage in the meantime. It's already doing political damage because, like the lie of the ceasefire, which there has been no ceasefire in Palestine since the very first day that this so-called ceasefire was declared. Israel has murdered Palestinians every day in their hundreds, destroyed hundreds of Palestinian homes and civilian infrastructure, blocked thousands of trucks of food. There has been no ceasefire. And there is no peace process. But that lie, those lies, and now with the lie of this Trump plan, as if this is some sort of relief, is taking the wind out of the sails of a lot of initiatives to get a response that would actually provide some modicum of protection to the Palestinian people and some modicum of accountability to the Israeli regime, because people are saying, well, now we have this thing, let's see how it goes, the ceasefire, the peace process, and now the Trump plan. So it's already doing damage there, but if it, to the degree that is implemented, including by this proxy occupation headquarters being set up inside the Green Line to direct the oppression of the Palestinian people, not from Washington, from just over the Green Line, it can do a lot of damage to people on the ground as well. I mean, you cannot believe, even as you're reading it, the terms of this unlawful proclamation by the UN Security Council. They actually adopt Trump's proposal for a Donald Trump-headed, it's not even the US, a Donald Trump-headed so-called Board of Peace in Orwellian terms, which is to serve as a transitional administration, governing all of Gaza, controlling all services and aid, controlling the movement of people in and out of Gaza, controlling all of the funding for the reconstruction of Gaza and the reconstruction itself. I mean, any chance for corruption there that Donald Trump and Tony Blair and Jared Kushner are going to be controlling the money that they will be pressing for from the Gulf and from Europe to bail out the Israelis? Where is that money going to go? We know very well where it's going to go. And it's given this very broad remit that is just unprecedented, I think. Vaguely formulated lines like any other task that may be required. Donald Trump can do whatever he wants in Gaza in this colonial grant of authority. It's not even colonial. It's King Leopold-esque. It's his private domain in that regard. It grants him upfront authority to establish whatever operational entities, transactional authorities at its own discretion. These are not UN bodies, so they explicitly didn't want to have a UN force. It is an external Trump-led body that has a UN stamp of approval. The closest parallel might be this proxy occupation force that was deployed to Haiti. It's not UN peacekeepers, it's armed forces, principally from Kenya, that are deployed there with the blessing of the UN Security Council. This is similar in that respect, and that's very dangerous because it means that the methodologies, the doctrine, the rules that apply to, for example, UN peacekeepers, already imperfect, but something, would not apply to this Trump colonial occupation. And there will be this kind of quisling body of Palestinian technocrats selected by Trump and his people. According to the resolution itself, they will take orders from Trump's Board of Peace, and they will report to Trump's Board of Peace, you know, ostensibly on their own land.
This phrase also that empowers the International Stabilization Force, this Israeli-American-run military force, because the resolution is also clear that it will coordinate with Israel and the United States. And Egypt has some role, but that basically means Israel, given how Egypt behaves. And it's entitled to use all necessary measures. Talk about that phrase and how it has appeared in previous resolutions and what that has led to.
Yeah, so you have the two bodies. One is the colonial governance of Gaza, which is this Trump-headed Board of Peace. And then under that colonial governance body, you've got this proxy occupation force called the International Stabilization Force, which has nothing to do with stabilization because it's going to destabilize the situation even further because its plan is to go in and forcibly disarm Palestine in Gaza. And this force is also an extension of Trump's power because it has will have a command that is approved by the Trump board. And as you say, it will explicitly operate in collaboration with Israel, the perpetrator of the genocide, as well as Egypt, of course, which is no protection for the Palestinian people either. And here's the other thing. Israel is given a veto over its members. Its members are going to be identified in cooperation with the Israeli regime, right? And then the idea is it will go in with these extraordinary powers and control the Palestinian survivors of the genocide in Gaza. It is empowered to secure the borders, which means to cage the Palestinians and to protect the Israeli regime. That's what this means. But I mean, just to think as you're reviewing this, there is a genocide. The UN Security Council has responded to that genocide with a resolution that for the first time is not about protecting the victims of the genocide. It's about protecting the perpetrators of the genocide. It's not about holding the perpetrators accountable. It's about disempowering and punishing the survivors of the genocide. So it will secure the borders, meaning cage the Palestinians in Gaza and protect the Israeli regime. It will control their movement in and out, just as the Israelis have done for decades and decades. It's supposed to, quote, stabilize the security environment, by which they mean suppress any resistance to the occupation, to the apartheid, to the genocide. Resistance that is the right of the Palestinian people under international law. So another breach there. It is supposed to demilitarize Gaza, but not the Israeli regime, which is the perpetrator of the genocide. It's upside down 1984. It's supposed to destroy Gaza's military defense capacities in the middle of a genocide, but not to touch Israeli so-called defense and military capacities. It's supposed to decommission the weapons of the resistance, the Palestinian resistance. It will not touch the Israeli perpetrators' weapons. It's going to also train a Palestinian police force. Of course, that is focused on controlling the Palestinian people inside of Gaza. No measures here to control an Israeli public that has enthusiastically participated in the genocide in Palestine and that continues, you know, that helped to block the aid, that supported persecution on the West Bank as well. No control there, but to control the supporters of the genocide. It is given a sort of vague remit to work for the very nefarious objectives of the Trump plan. And it's supposed to explicitly collaborate with Israel in doing this. And while it has a line in there about protecting civilians, this is a force that is set up principally to protect Israel. It is not going to stand up to Israeli aggression and attacks on civilians. That is obvious. It's supposed to monitor the ceasefire, but what it will be monitoring is any threat to the ceasefire from the Palestinian side, while, as usual, Israel will continue, as it has, to violate the ceasefire on a daily basis. No reference to the hundreds killed, the massive destruction of civilian infrastructure during this so-called ceasefire. Basically, the mission is to control, contain, disarm, and further disempower the Palestinians victimized by the genocide without touching the regime that is perpetrating it, and to provide security, and the first time in a UN resolution, not for the victims of the genocide, but for its perpetrator. The resolution explicitly authorizes Israeli regime forces to continue to occupy Gaza unlawfully, according to the International Court of Justice, until the Americans, the U.S.-led Board of Peace, and the Israeli regime forces that are mentioned specifically as being a part of this decision-making, until they decide that the Israeli forces should leave. And even then, it envisages that Israeli forces will remain indefinitely in the so-called security perimeter, which, as you know, includes some of the most important land in Gaza, some of the most fertile land in Gaza, leaving the Palestinians in the sand of the beach overall. And it gives them not only a two-year mandate, but the possibility of an extension, once again, in consultation with Israel, but not with Palestine, Israel and Egypt, but not with Palestine. It's absolutely insanity. It's unlawful. It's ultra vires, and it needs to be opposed by everybody.
How can it be opposed? What are the recourses here?
This is a part of the problem. So remember that the Security Council, which has had the power to intervene in this genocide for the full 2 years, has failed to act to protect the rights of the Palestinian people for more than 2 years of this genocide. Then when it finally acts, it does so to deny the rights of the Palestinians. It doesn't intervene to protect the rights of the Palestinians once again. And that's a problem with the Security Council. As I said, the Security Council has a lot of power. And its failures so far have been failures by design, because the council is set up in such a way to ensure the impunity of the five permanent members. And in this case, the United States, there is no judicial review of the Security Council. If it's not following the rules of international law, it becomes a rogue mechanism that threatens the rights of all of us. And that is what has happened here. That's what I'm saying. There's no judicial review. The International Court of Justice could take up a request for an advisory opinion and interpret the mandate in a way that is consistent with international law, but it can't overturn it. So that means that it's up to, you know, all the people who are horrified about this to bring pressure to bear on member states of the UN to try to undo this first, to challenge it at every step, to discredit it the way it needs to be discredited, to push governments not to go along with this ruse. For 2 years, it's going to be difficult to stop it because it has a two-year mandate. At the end of those 2 years, when that mandate has to be reviewed, you could have another vote in the Security Council. If there were a direct assault on it, the U.S. would simply veto it and continue as it was. If there's a refusal to remove it, the U.S. will simply ignore it if it wants to continue and do it without the U.N. blessing as well. So they have created a Frankenstein monster that's not going to be easy to contain. There are plenty of things in there that will help it to unravel on its own. Trying to get troops that will participate with this insane colonial scheme and other things as well, you know, whether it's going to be sustainable. But, you know, what we can do is we can press states to back off. They could overturn it, but they won't overturn it because they won't be able to get a resolution through that the U.S. will approve. There are alternative tracks that can be pursued. Of course, many of them are in the streets and our own mobilization. But if we can create an alternative track in the UN General Assembly under Uniting for Peace that focuses on accountability of the Israeli regime, which has been completely ignored here, and build political support from member states to try to get that passed in the GA and to frame a protection force for that moment in the future when it becomes possible, that political work can continue. But in the immediate term, we are up against quite a tall brick wall with what they have created here. Now, why did they do it? As you know, the way that the United States functions in diplomacy is not with skilled diplomats. Their diplomats are usually not very skilled because they don't need to be. They have power, they have carrots and sticks, and they always deploy threats and inducements in order to get their way in this voting. I'm told by diplomats that this was the most extreme badgering and threatening and bribing action by the United States that they have seen. They really turned up the heat in typical Trump style and deployed whatever carrot and sticks they have. So Russia, in the middle of sensitive discussions with the Americans on Ukraine and wanting to get the U.S. to ratify its retention of certain parts of Ukraine and so on, you know, that clearly was deployed. China, in the middle of sensitive negotiations with the U.S. on trade and tariffs that they have prioritized, they have thrown the Palestinians under the bus in favor of those transactional reasons. And that goes straight across the 15 members, the other 14 members of the council, where all of these things were deployed. Then you have the threat that was unleashed by the Americans and Ambassador Waltz himself and repeated privately and publicly that if you don't agree to this, we are going to unleash the dogs of genocide on Gaza. So it was a mafia shakedown in classic Trump Roy Cohn style. And many diplomats have commented that they believe that was true. That was would have been the next move. Was to simply return to the accelerated genocide in Gaza. So they used that as a threat. Then you have the betrayal of the Palestinian Authority, which was very active in telling Russia and China and the Arab group and the Europeans and others to please support this proposal. So the Palestinian Authority, as you know, Ali, and this is an issue for the Palestinian people to reform their own institutions, but you're supposed to have a state of Palestine represented in the UN. You're supposed to have the PLO in charge of foreign policy, and then you have the Palestinian Authority as this local body working out of Ramallah. In fact, those bodies, as you know, are merged, which means that the Palestinian Authority, which has no legitimacy vis-a-vis its own people, which operates under occupation, which operates under the boot of the Israelis, that has its own personal interest involved, which relies on funding from the Europeans and the Gulf, is directing the foreign policy of Palestine and therefore of what they say in the UN. And so member states will always go to the Palestinian mission and say, what should we do? And here they're told, you have to support this. Don't veto it, support it. And then to complete what I've called the perfect storm of complicity, the Arab states also had a major push to get this thing supported. Remember the Saudis, who were very active here, were in the middle of their discussions with MBS in Washington, in the middle of their discussions for security guarantees with the Americans. And now they have been identified by Trump as a major non-NATO ally, which means that the U.S. will come to the defense of the regime when it's threatened. And advanced weapon sales deals, including advanced fighter jets from the United States. So the Saudis, once again, and not for the first time, threw the Palestinians under the bus. The Egyptians, the second largest recipient of U.S. foreign aid after Israel, playing a similar role in telling everyone that they have to support it, and many in the broader Arab group. So if you are Russia or China or somebody from Latin America or Africa, and you go to the Palestinians and you go to the Arabs and you ask, what should we do? You're being told, support this resolution, otherwise they will unleash the dogs of genocide. And that's how you explain that there were four Muslim countries on the council that voted in favor, including Algeria, which had been the tip of the spear in defending the Palestinians in the Security Council, as well as Pakistan and Somalia and Sierra Leone, which is a Muslim majority country. So there's your perfect storm of complicity. It doesn't excuse anyone. They exceeded the power of the Security Council. They violated international law. They abandoned the Palestinians, and they created a Frankenstein monster that's going to take a lot of work to now dismantle. Nobody gets an excuse for having done so.
Tell me if I'm wrong about this, Craig, but under the resolution, any country that's willing and that the US says is okay could join the ISF. So if it doesn't find volunteers, the US can say, we're joining the ISF. And under the clause of all necessary measures, the United States Air Force could start bombing Gaza and say, we have a UN mandate to bomb Gaza. Trump has said no boots on the ground, no American boots on the ground, but they could say the U.S. Air Force is part of the ISF, and they could start bombing Gaza themselves, claiming that they're doing so with a mandate from the U.N. Security Council, and it will have been Russia and China, the only two countries who could have stopped this atrocity, who once again allowed it to happen, and to me, it's inexcusable.
It is inexcusable, and the scenario that you point out is correct. You could also see them using it as a justification for their CIA thugs to be deployed on the ground, their mercenaries that they're so fond of using that they built the whole Gaza Humanitarian Foundation on, and who are now still hanging out in the region waiting for the next orders. And all indications are that they will be involved in this new monstrosity as well. So it is a real threat. The Russians and the Chinese knew better. There is a theory out there that the other powers like the idea of the U.S. being drawn deeper and deeper into a quagmire in Western Asia to exhaust its resources, and it's standing even further while they continue to focus on their own priorities as well. I mean, I think that's not totally insane as a motivation in the end, but they have abandoned the Palestinian people. Yes, they consult with the PA's representatives, but before this thing was adopted, we already had very clear statements of the Palestinian people, which in three manifestations, the Palestinian civil society and their networks of NGOs and so on, the human rights organizations, but also the political factions, except for Mahmoud Abbas's Fatah, and the active resistance groups as well. So Palestine had spoken. They knew very well that this isn't something Palestine wanted. And you will remember these proposals under Uniting for Peace and so on for a force that would have been based on the consent of the Palestinians, who could decide who's included in that force, when they come, how long they stay, and when they have to leave. This flips it totally on its head, because this force, in the terms of the resolution itself, is to be consulted with the Israeli regime and not with the Palestinians. So it is an occupation force. It is a force that is empowered to be violent, impose itself against the will of the indigenous people, to carry out acts that are by definition a violation of international law as reaffirmed by the International Court of Justice just months ago. So it is as bad as it sounds. It is extremely dangerous. And the world has abandoned Palestine now. You see how we've come full circle. After the partition against the will of the indigenous people of Palestine, getting a UN stamp of approval, so-called. And then, you know, when the UN changed in the 1960s and 70s to include all formerly colonized countries who built a coalition of the global south to fight against Israeli oppression, to fight against apartheid in South Africa, to work for decolonization of countries, then the unipolar moment in which the US consolidated its control over these issues, and now the entire world bowing down to the empire against international law because either they don't care or they're afraid of Caligula, who has now taken over the empire as a madman that can bring consequences to bear on them if they don't go along. It is a dangerous moment in history. As always, the Palestinians are on the front line, but these risks extend to all of us in a world where you have a rogue Security Council operating outside the bounds of international law with the powers that it's given under the charter to deploy force against the will of indigenous people. The governments of the world have again betrayed the Palestinian people. The international institutions have again betrayed the Palestinian people. The people of the world, the whole world is on the side of Palestine, now more than ever. And what this reveals is, and I think this is really the call to action, is that the governments of these 15 countries and other countries around the world do not represent us. These are cowed, corrupted, captured governments that are operating in interests that have nothing to do with the will of the people or the needs of the people. And those governments have come together to perpetrate atrocities in our name. And we really have to redouble the struggle against all of these governments, beginning with the 15 members of the Security Council in all regions, including in the Arab region, in the Muslim world, and elsewhere, because this is not what the people want. This is clearly not what the world wants. This is what these corrupt institutions want. And we have to continue to fight against this. And most of that is going to be in the street. It's going to be boycott and divestment and sanctions, as I always say, legal prosecutions of Israeli perpetrators. It's going to be mass demonstrations, strikes, which are increasingly showing themselves to help. It's going to be direct action and civil disobedience and education. It's going to be all of those things, but it's also going to be to try to take back these institutions that can influence the situation. Security Council is the problem. It's not going to be fixed. Let's use what we have to try to challenge it, including in the UN General Assembly, but especially in the streets. We have a duty to ourselves, as well as to Palestine, to take back our own countries from the grasp of these nefarious forces that are making us all complicit in mass murder. This should be the latest wake-up call. They corrupted our governments, they've now corrupted international institutions, and they've climbed all the way to the top to take the levers of power of the Security Council, which is a danger in the end to all of us. So the world needs to stand up against those who have captured governments and institutions.
Craig, thank you so much for your sharp and incisive comments. We're so grateful to you for speaking out, for helping us clarify all this.
Always honored to be with you. Thank you all very much.
Thank you, Craig.
That was international human rights lawyer Craig McIver. Thank you for tuning into Electronic Intifada Radio. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. For more interviews, reports, and analysis, along with feature articles, podcasts, and our live stream, check out electronicintifada.net. Produced by Pierre Loisel, Nora Barrows-Friedman, and Tamara Nassar. The Electronic Intifada is a program service of the Middle East Cultural and Charitable Society, Incorporated, a 501c3 nonprofit organization.
What you just heard was the latest episode of the Electronic Intifada Radio. You've been listening to Arab Voices, a syndicated radio talk show on dozens of radio stations in the US and Europe since 2002. Our shows are archived online and you can listen to them by visiting arabvoices.net. And that does it for the show today. Thanks for listening. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Until we meet next week, peace on earth.